Welcome to the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast from Bradford Literature Festival. In this episode, join Writers Mosaic's John Sadiq for a gripping exploration into the dark hearts of storytelling with leading voices in global crime fiction. Saima Mir, Nadine Matheson, and Kia Abdullah come together to discuss the creative drive, personal journeys, and cultural forces that shape their narratives. Recorded live at the 2025 Festival, this conversation reveals what lies beneath the surface of every killer story.
Good morning, ladies and gentlemen. My name is John Sadiq. I am the project coordinator for Writers Mosaic and the Royal Literary Fund in the north of England. This event is being held by Writers Mosaic, which is a wonderful online magazine of global majority writing. So I urge you to check that out whenever you get a chance. And we're very blessed to have three global crime queens, and I'm going to be an honorary queen for the day, which is absolutely fantastic. So just to kind of give you a little bit of background to how this came to be, and then I'll turn you over to our wonderful queens of crime. This is going to sound like a strange thing, but I try to do things in a different way sometimes. One of my ways of when I'm writing a book is to pick a subject that I don't know anything about and then to kind of learn about it instead of trying to be an expert. I think that way we actually learn some things. So I don't know anything about crime writing. I'm not an expert in crime writing. So when I met Saima Mir the other week, a wonderful launch of Anita Rani's thing about the Brontes, that was on Sky Arts. Has it been on now? Yeah. I said, listen, I've got a stage, I've got a slot, and we've got some money burning holes in our pockets. What should we do? And so the Global Crime Queens was born. So here they are. So I'd like to introduce you to, they're in the wrong order on here now. You see, I have a piece of paper around. This is the wonderful Nadine Matheson, author of, most recently, The Kill List. Quite a grisly thing, actually.
Just a bit.
It is a bit grisly. I will not talk about that fridge.
Oh, it's the best. Sorry,
oh my God. Nadine was born and raised in Deptford and now practices as a criminal defense lawyer. She won the Crime University Crime Writing Competition. She has an MA in creative writing. The Jigsaw Man was her first crime novel and was loved by readers around the world. It was shortlisted for the Dead Good Reader and the Adult Diverse Book Awards in 2022. It's been translated into 15 languages. And she's also the host of the podcast The Conversation with Nadine Matheson. And, ladies and gentlemen, round of applause. Two nights ago, she has just been appointed chair of the Crime Writers Association. So there we go.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. Yeah.
I managed to sneak that one in.
I know. Well done.
Saima Mir, who, well, Bradford knows needs no introduction to the wonderful Saima Mir. She's an award-winning journalist and writer. She's written for The Guardian, The Times, The Independent, The Daily Telegraph, and worked for the BBC. Her work originally appeared in Anthology, It's Not About the Burqa, in 2019, and The Best Most Awful Job in 2020. Her novel, The Khan, was published by Point Blank in 2021, and its follow-up, Vengeance, was published last year. The Khan has been optioned by BBC Studios. I want to know where we're up to with that, because it should be seen. Saima is a recipient of the Commonwealth Broadcast Association World View Award. That's a long one. And the K. Blundell Trust Award. Saima's work has been long listed for the S.I. Lees Literary Prize and the Bath Novel Award, and her screenplay, Ruby and Matt, has been optioned by Rendition Films. And then last but not least, it's just that you're sitting furthest away, Kia Abdullah is a best-selling author and travel writer. Her books include Take It Back, which is a Guardian and Telegraph Thriller of the Year, Truth Be Told, which was shortlisted for the Diverse Book Awards, and Next of Kin, which won the Adult Diverse Fiction Award and was long listed for the CWA Gold Dagger Awards. Those People Next Door was a Waterstones Thriller of the Month pick, and Kia has also been selected for the Times Crime Club. Kia's written for the New York Times, The Guardian, Financial Times, The Times, and the BBC, and is founder of the wonderful Substack Asian Booklist, a non-for-profit that advocates for diversity in publishing and helps readers discover new books by British Asian authors. And her new book, which has only just come out last month, What Happens in the Dark. Very amazing. So, biogs aside, I just want to celebrate the fact that we have three women of the global majority writing crime and sitting on this stage. That is the entire point of this hour, quite honestly. Just that is enough in a world that, you know, often doesn't recognize people of the global majority. Here are three global crime queens. Round of applause, please. Yeah, and I'm just going to keep coming back to that. Whenever there's a lull, I just go, celebration, global people, oh, like that, you see.
Yeah. Huh?
I'll break into a dance. I'll dance anywhere. I don't need any excuse for dancing, not at all. We'll all dance. So what I'd love to do is, because you may or may not know their work, I am really going to try and be spoilers free. We will not speak more about that fridge. Okay? We're not going to speak about the fridge. Ah! You can ask my wife. I didn't. I was awake all night after that
fridge. But that's what I want. That's the best reaction you can get.
Honestly. Anyway, so what I'd love, because you may or may not know the books, could you each introduce your protagonist to us for a couple of minutes each? That, I thought that would be a lovely thing.
Okay, who's going to pass? Oh, me? Nadine. God. Okay, so The Cure List is the third book in my Detective Inspector Angelica Henley series. So Angelica Henley, she is the protagonist. She is my main character, and I absolutely adore her. So my books are based in Southeast London. And Henley's backstory is that she leads an elite unit called the Serial Crimes Unit, and they're based in this disused police station called Greenwich Police Station. So it's a very small unit, and as the title suggests, they investigate serial crimes. But she also suffers from PTSD, because if we go back to the first book, The Jigsaw Man, about a year before that, she was stabbed by a serial killer. And when she was stabbed, she also discovered that she was pregnant. So with Inspector Angelica Henley, as a lawyer, actually, I've always been interested in thinking about how investigating officers, how they must bring their cases home with them, because they work with an investigation from the very beginning. And I always wondered how that would affect someone. And for Henley, say, being a woman, being a wife, being a mother, but she's fully dedicated to her job, how could that not affect her home life and how she manages that? And she manages that, but she has a bit of conflict with her husband, who does not like the fact that she's out there dealing with serial killers. But people ask if Henley's me, and I'm like, no, she is nothing like me. There's too many issues going on there, so she's definitely not like me. The only similarities we have is that her family originally from Grenada, my family's from Grenada, and her partner, so in the unit, DC Ramuta, he's from Bradford, because my granddad lived in Huddersfield and was from it, so I had to give a little bit of a dedication there.
Awesome.
So that's Henley.
That's Henley. Simon?
So I write a character called Jia Khan. Jia Khan is the daughter of a criminal kingpin, and she's had the privilege of being steeped in lots of money as a result of his evil doings, illicit doings. So she's been to Oxford, she's a barrister, she's about to become a judge, and she's left this fictional city, which actually was inspired by Bradford. And the reason it's fictional is because I was writing crime and I didn't want to do all these bad things in the city that I love, that is hugely misunderstood and maligned. So she, again, people ask me if she's me. My dad is not a criminal kingpin, but a lot of, and I didn't go to Oxford, but a lot of the stuff that she handles in life, I've handled. So she is a really smart woman who goes into rooms and has to navigate them differently because she happens to be of British Pakistani origin. She's female, so when she goes into rooms with men, the things they expect her to say and know, she has to figure out how she can behave in a way to get what she needs. She, at the start of The Khan, which is the first book, she's estranged from her husband, who she's been with since she was young. She's been estranged from him about 16 years. And she's got a child who's now a teenager. What else can I tell you about her? She's very grey. So nothing is black and white for Jia Khan. It's all in the grey. But she loves her family, and that's what this book is about. I suppose she's been described as sort of if Michael Corleone was a British Asian woman. The best. That's her.
What Happens in the Dark is my fifth novel. In it, we meet Safa Saleem. She is a journalist who used to work for one of the UK's most respected broadsheets. But following a fall from grace, she's ended up at a local rag in East London. And one day she's called into her editor's office and asked to get back in touch with Lily. Lily is the nation's favourite breakfast TV presenter. And they happen to be childhood best friends. Lily was seen on TV that morning with bruises on her body. So Safa gets back in touch, and initially Lily says, you know, nothing's going on, it's all innocent. But then one day the police are called to Lily's house, and there they find a dead body. So Safa has to investigate what's happened that night. I kind of think of her as giving voice to the voiceless. She used to be a young language broker. What I mean by that is her parents couldn't read, write or speak English, similar to mine. And so from a young age, she's negotiating really complicated systems like the NHS, DWP, HMRC. And that leads to tragedy in her backstory, which I won't spoil. And so as a grown up, she really wants to represent the people who can't speak for themselves. And even though it leads her into a vulnerable position, that's what she stands up for. And one thing I'm really proud of in this novel as well is I had a habit of writing Muslim men quite negatively, because growing up I lacked role models, but her dad is somebody that I really love, because in a way I kind of wish that he was the role model I had growing up. So in that sense, I'm really proud of that novel.
Love it. I love the dad.
Oh, thank
actually,
you.
Yeah. And that's an amazing thing you can do, actually. I always say that the one who writes things down is the one who actually gets to dictate what the history is.
Absolutely.
As it were. So we can change our families if we want to, if we're authors, which is a fantastic thing.
So you can course correct.
Yeah, course corrections, absolutely, as you kind of sort yourself out, as it were, you know, from their stuff, as it were. I'd like to kind of lean into a couple of questions around genre a little bit. And, you know, when you encounter, because I say I'm not a crime reader, so when you encounter a new genre, you get the expectation of what the genre is. And of course, when you are a writer and you're within your genre or whatever you're writing, then of course you learn how to kind of put your elbows out and kind of occupy that space. So coming into crime, yeah, I don't think I've read a crime book in a long, long time. You know, Sherlock Holmes, and I used to watch Columbo, you know, kind of, so Columbo's my guy. And I was just so amazed at these different worlds. Basically, each of you have tackled it in a completely different way. Just, that was so unexpected. And so I would, which question shall I go for first? Yeah, let's go with this. You've each built three very different worlds. So Syma, for example, is this hugely multi-layered world. And at times it's kind of almost like overpowering the kind of the amount of characters that you meet and the things going on in the background. And, you know, I think the kind of, I don't want to compare it to The Godfather. You know, but there is a God. I started calling it the Godmother at one point. but there is that massive sort of layering of things with The Kill List, with Nadine's book. It's kind of more procedural. It's much more kind of your cop sort of drama kind of thing that you kind of, not that you would expect, because she takes you all over the place and to the refrigerator. and yet at the same time, there's this kind of through line that kind of takes you through, but you kind of know the territory that you're in. And then with Kia's world, that she built for what happens in the dark, it's got a completely different thing written on the cover, which is really, because it's a proof.
Yeah, the hardback looks different.
Yeah, so it looks completely different. So don't go off this whatsoever. Yeah. So what happens in the dark, I'll put it that way so I can see the title. It's a much smaller world. It's not a little world, but it's a kind of like family and friends and kind of, and you're very, very much with Safa all the way through it, as it were, and Lily. So I'd like to ask you about your approaches to world building, because that is being an author, that is an area that I'm kind of really interested in, you know, how you built these worlds.
I think for me, because so they are police procedurals, but having my background as a criminal solicitor, and I've been in criminal law for 20 years. So for when I'm writing these books, it's reflecting the world that I've moved in. Because I've always read crime fiction. But, and I said, and being a criminal solicitor, I've sat in police interview rooms with detectives who are detectives of colour. So they've been black, Asian, Chinese, everything, male, female. But then I was reading all these crime books and I wasn't seeing the world I was moving in reflected in those books. So that was always one of my number ones priorities, to show the world that I live in and for readers to see that world. Like, it shouldn't be unusual to have a black female detective inspector, because it's not unusual. But if you were to pick up a book off the bookshelf, you just wasn't seeing that. But for me, even though I'm writing police procedurals, always, even though you keep going on about the fridge, and it's a good scene, the fridge is a good scene. But for me, like, you always feel like you can have these, I say these dark, really macabre moments, but I have to balance it out with Henley's home life and how it affects her. And that's one thing I always try and keep in vain when I'm writing the books, is how these cases affect everyone. So from Henley, the detective, to Ezra, who's like their IT superstar specialist guy, how these crimes affect them and how they deal with it when they go home. But the role, there's a scene in The Jigsaw Man in the first one when Henley goes to Belmarsh prison with the trainee at the time, Remuta, and the governor of the prison, he approaches Remuta, and he's a young Asian man, but he just assumes that he's the one in charge. And she has to step in and go, no, he steps back and she steps forward. I'm the one in charge. And I remember being going to court in the early days, and it was the ushers would assume that I wasn't the solicitor, that I'm either the defendant. I mean, if I'd be a rubbish defendant's girlfriend, I would just never go to court and police stations. But they would assume I was the girlfriend or the social worker, but anyone else but the solicitor. So my experiences in terms of, you know, dealing with those sort of discrimination stereotypes, I put that in the books also. So that's how I build. I build the world based on the world that I know.
Same. I didn't actually set out to write crime fiction. I set out to write a story about family, about Lairs and family and the complicated nature of being estranged from people. But the crime thing of it came in because I was a journalist here at the local paper, and I've actually been in this room covering council meetings, things like that. So I used to hear these amazing crime stories, and the editor in that big glass, used to be the glass building here where they used to print the local paper. I got a call, the news editor said, can you go downstairs into the reception because somebody's here with a story? And I was a trainee then. And I went down and there was this guy, and he'd had a lot to drink and he sort of smelt a bit. And he said, do you know, this city is run by these 12 people. And I listened to him, and I listened to all of this really interesting stuff that he was telling me. And I just made notes and I thought, it's not a story he's going to leave. But something about that stayed with me. And then every time I went to cover stories in court and I saw defendants and I saw their mothers, and I saw young British Pakistani men and their families. And that stayed with me, the fact that we were talking about this crime and saying, this is awful, but there was a journey. There was a journey there to those men ending up in the dock. And I wanted to write about that.
Mm.
So there was that. There was also, I covered the story of Sharon Beshenivsky, the policewoman who was shot here. And I was sent, the day she was shot and the copters were out, and I was sent there. And the world's press had arrived because a policewoman had been shot. And when you're a local reporter, the national reporters know you because they know that you're going to have the inside track on what's going on. So this guy from the Daily Mail followed me. And Cafe Lahore was open, which is now, I think it's called the British Asian Kitchen, still by the Alhambra. And he followed me in there. And I saw this room full of young, really attractive British Asians who were eating curry and having school dinner puddings with it, that kind of thing. I thought, this is really interesting. And I said to the guy behind the till, I said to him in Urdu, I switched languages, I said, do you own this place? He said, yeah. And I said, this guy behind me, I don't want him to know what we're talking about, but what I want is the number for the travel agent who's been held hostage over there. And he said, yeah, I've got it. And so I had this entire interaction. And I thought, this is an entire generation that's not being talked about, that's fascinating, that's good looking, that's smart, that's clever. It's just a new way of being British. And I wanted to write about that.
Mm.
So that was where that world came from.
Fabulous.
Thank you.
My books are very much set in East London. That's where I grew up. And I find it a really fascinating place because it's constantly in flux. But one thing that doesn't tend to change is that the poorest people in the city tend to flock there because that's where the most affordable housing is. And growing up, I really felt the juxtaposition of poverty. You know, my parents were immigrants from Bangladesh. There were eight, you know, I had seven siblings, so there were eight of us. Tower Hamlets might still be one of the worst areas for child poverty in the whole country. But outside my window, I could see Canary Wharf, and you know, it's green light flashing at night. And so that comparison was really fascinating. And so I wanted to set my books in that world where different sorts of people are chafing against each other. And so Safa represents, I mean, Lily came from poverty too in the book, but she went to Oxbridge and managed to find her way out of poverty, whereas Safa still lives in a tiny one-bedroom flat in a block of flats. And they drifted apart. As you do, it's really difficult to keep in touch when your paths diverge in such a dramatic way. But one of the themes in the novel is that privilege doesn't necessarily protect you from violence. So what one of the themes is violence against women. And so Lily stands up and says, you know, nothing's going on. You know, the bruises are innocent. And at one point, Safa says, you know, if you can't speak, who among us can? Because ostensibly you're this rich, white, famous woman, and I'm trying to protect all these brown, disadvantaged women. But actually, just because you're privileged, it doesn't mean that you don't suffer from the same shame, generations of shame that tell you, you know, if you, unless you speak at your weakest, we doubt you. You know, if something happened to you, why didn't you speak then? And so taking the time to gather your courage makes you more likely to be doubted. And so that's something that I just felt was very natural in East London, because Lily still lives there, but she lives in Narrow Street, which is, you know, where Gordon Ramsay lives. I think Ian McKellen has a place there, and she lives in a townhouse. And you can find these pockets of privilege among the poverty of Tower Hamlets. And so I just find it a really fascinating place.
Wonderful. You've kind of preempted in a way. I was going to ask you about kind of how you kind of, you know, stretch the genre in many ways to kind of, you know, to kind of fit what you wanted to write.
But crime is, you know, people like the literary establishment look down on crime. And I remember when I first got the cover of Take It Back, my first novel, I was like, John, this looks like a airport novel. And you know what I mean by an airport novel? You know, something you pick up, you read for 2 or 3 hours, you finish it, you chuck it away. And I had poured so much love and craft into it. I mean, the first lesson I learned is crime sells. And so it's fine that your novel looks that way. But actually, the literary establishment frown upon us, but crime covers the great themes of family and love and death and crime and violence. And so actually it's best suited for these big themes in life. And it's not just the preserve of literary fiction exactly. That you see on the Booker shortlists.
Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, I always say that, for me, I always feel like crime novels, they do reflect every aspect of society. So thinking like my second novel, The Binding Room, not only are we dealing with like mental health issues, which affect everyone, and also in so many communities where they don't, they'd rather not talk about mental health issues. And in the second novel, they cover it up by saying, it's not mental health issues, you must be possessed by the devil. So there's, you know, it's a commentary on organised religion as well. And then in The Kill List, it's looking at the effect on communities that murder, you know, that a murder can happen to a young person, how that affects communities and how that affects people later on in life. So for me, crime novels reflect every single aspect of society. So when they're looked down upon, it's frustrating and it's annoying, because as Kia said, sometimes they, you know, they'll put literary up here and crime is way, 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 way down on the bottom. And it's like, that's not how it should be, because we work hard on these books and it has all those things that you want. You know, it has great plots. We have to think about our characters. Like, I never want my characters to be flat. I always want them to feel like, if you meet Henley, like, you can sit with her, or say sit with her in the pub, you can have a drink with her. If you meet, well, you don't want to meet the serial killers, but if you meet the serial killers, you know, like,
you don't want to know what happens with that fridge.
The fridge is cool, but you want them to feel like fully rounded people. So, you know, they're not easy books to write at all. You know, when they talk about, oh, the twist, yeah, you have to think about that and you have to craft it. And I need to make sure that when you pick up any of our books, that from the minute you open up that first page, that you follow the characters and you follow that story right through to the end. So if you do get to the fridge, you're like, oh my God, I can't believe Nadine did that. But I need to carry on and flip over the pages. And you get to the end, I was like, that was a good journey. Let me get the next book.
No, I agree. And I think literature could learn a great deal from, you know, from not looking down its nose, yeah. Honestly, you know.
Stories are powerful, aren't they? They're the most powerful things we have. They change people. And the things that try are powerful are what other people try to control and look down upon. And that's a thing with commercial fiction and with crime, is we can talk about really complicated things that newspapers might want to talk about in a them and us kind of way. But we can write about things in a we kind of way and say, actually, here's this character. Okay, she's made these choices. come on this journey with me to say why she killed that person or what happened, without somebody being outraged and saying, we now need to go on Newsnight and debate this. And, you know, the audience is so much bigger. And, yeah, we just change people without actually them knowing that they're being changed.
No, that's really good. It's like people fear pop music, don't they? You know, if you kind of listen to classical music and things like that. We always say if somebody can't appreciate Jimi Hendrix kind of thing, then there's something wrong with you. And I would never trust you, basically. And it's the same with, you know, you have an access to much wider range of people, so you actually can do more work.
And one of the best reader emails I've gotten recently is someone saying, I haven't read for ages, I haven't picked up a book for ages, but I found your book and I picked it up and it's got me back in love with reading again. And that's always one of the best reactions you can get from reading. That's what you want.
Absolutely.
One of the other weird contradictory things about it is, so I obviously write this woman who is a baddie, but she's a beautiful baddie. And she has a Birkin bag and she has her nice shoes. And when I was a young woman growing up, I didn't see any brown women represented like that. You know, we were either had our heads covered and we were sort of like being oppressed, but she's emancipated and she frees other people. And so that, for a young woman who happens to be of that background reading that, that's really freeing.
Absolutely.
That's like, wow, okay. And I'm not suggesting women should be criminal kingpins in any way, shape or form, but... You know, we have.
But there
agency.
Are vacancies.
There are vacancies. There's a lot of money to be made.
Yeah.
But, you know, if you need a lawyer.
Yeah. You don't have to fit within the box that Western society tells you that you need to fit within. You don't have to do that. You can be a criminal lawyer in your heels and your Louboutins and your, you know, Birkin bag.
Fantastic. So we're talking about the reader. So I'd love to explore with you your kind of approaches to writing. You know, being a kind of author myself, that's kind of always how I, you know, being an author reading a book, it doesn't give you, I just want to be a reader sometimes. And actually it can get in the way being an author when you read a book, because you just actually want to just enjoy the thing, you know. But I'd love to ask each of you about your approaches to writing. So how do you kind of, you know, find your way each day to the typewriter? It's not a typewriter anymore, is it?
Yeah. Say, oh, to the, you're showing to the, your age, to the, John.
I am very old, yes, but I wear it well. Huh? A quill. How do you pick up your quill each day,
the
madam?
The agent waits for exactly. The manuscript and the pigeon carrier arrives. Wouldn't that be amazing?
But laborious, I haven't got the energy for that.
So, Kia, what's your approach to the quill?
My approach to the quill. So I am a very structured writer, and I've learned that that's my process. And so... especially in crime, they either call you a plotter or a pantser, so you're flying by the seat of your pants. And I am very much, I know what's going to happen in my book. I have a beginning, middle, and an end. I sit down and I almost plot chapter by chapter. I did try a different approach with book four, and I just found myself in the weeds. I didn't know what on earth I was doing. It was in the middle of the pandemic as well, and so in a way, that was really difficult for me. One interesting thing was, I never thought of my work in the classic kind of three-act structure. And I read this book called Stealing Hollywood by Alexandra Sokolov. And I realized that actually, retrospectively, my novels followed that structure anyway. And I think that was because I just was a reader. And I think even if you watch a lot of movies, you have an inherent understanding of what a story is. And the three-act structure is kind of summarized as you get your heroine up a tree, then you throw stones at her, so you make things worse, and then you get her down. And my work just initially followed that instinctively. Now I do kind of think of it in a more structured way. So what will happen in Act 1, Act 2, Act 3? And I even have a Google Sheet kind of breaking down everything. And then I just sit down and I try and write 1,500 words a day. I have to remind myself sometimes not to throw good hours after bad. And so if I haven't hit my word count, just sitting there isn't going to do it. So sometimes just go and take a walk or do something else and come back to it.
Mm. Awesome.
I'm a pantser.
You're a pantser.
I'm a pantser. Yeah, I know the beginning and I know the end and I don't know how I'm going to get there. And I know my character journey, but I don't know what's going to happen. And I do a lot more thinking than writing. I used to try and do the 1,500 word thing, but it just doesn't work for me. That's just not how my brain is. And I have family, I have three kids, and I have other work, so I do a lot of thinking, and my scene lives with me, and I think about it until it hits me, and then I go and just bash it out. What else do? I don't have that. I wish I've tried that. your spreadsheet right. thing.
Oh, I've seen
that. I wish I was that person, but I've just got to accept that I'm not. Maybe I've got ADHD. I'm more and more convinced that I am.
The thing is, the books are there. That's the thing. However you get there.
The thing is, birthing a book like that is painful. And so much of it's just keeping the faith that it is going to get there.
See, that's the thing that frightens me, that you get 20,000 words down one alley and you find that it's a blind alley and then you have to backtrack. And so, yeah, I find that way terrifying.
It is terrifying. It's absolutely petrifying. But I think that's part of what makes me do it as well. And then I get to the end, and then what I do is then I make a list of the chapters and I put what's in each chapter. And then I look, okay, does this structure work? And if it doesn't, then I move things around. Having said that, I am in the middle of an edit. So, you know, I am a bit scared from my notes from my editor. I have done some patronizing notes on there.
Is this number 3?
Number 3, yeah.
Yeah.
The final one as well. The final.
Well, I'm going to bookend the pencil because I'm very much a plotter. Even though I'm not the spreadsheet person, like, I think of your spreadsheets and there's something. I'm telling you, they're amazing. I'm like, it's just not me. But I'm very much a planner. But, you know, you keep talking about the fridge scene. But with the kill list, it was an actual fridge I saw. I went on my morning walk and I saw the fridge and I just thought, oh, I can use that and I'm going to use it in my book. But how it will start is that it will always start at the scene. So with the kill list, even though I do plan my books, it's the scene I had that popped into my head was, it was a man on his deathbed and he was being asked what his last words were. And his last words were, I didn't do it. I'm an innocent man. And I thought, oh, how does that tie? Because I write a series. How does that tie into Henley and how does that tie into her series? I mean, yeah, into her story. And with the second book, The Binding Room, it started because I was in court one day. I was at Worth Crown Court and in the courtroom next door to me, because you're always paying attention to what's going on. And so in the courtroom next door to me, there's a lot going on in and out, a lot of people involved. So I asked the barrister, I'm like, what's your case about? And he said to me, oh, we've got a family who are up for manslaughter because they was up for GBH, so grievous bodily harm, wound with intent. And because they've been trying to exorcise a demon from their family member, not accepting that he had mental health issues. So that just stuck in my head. And I thought, that's going to be the plot for book 2. And in book 1, I live by the River Thames. And it came out of an assignment. And it was like, oh, because I'd always see mudlarkers on the riverbank. I thought, oh, what have they found? An arm. Instead of finding they're looking for treasure. But you didn't find any treasure that morning. You found an arm.
It's great being friends with Nadine.
I'm a great person to have. But that's how, so, you know, that will always give birth to the story. But I then do, okay, now I have to do an outline. So I do this like a chapter outline, like a summary of each chapter. But sometimes, you know, even though I said I know beginning, middle and end, sometimes subplots just come out of nowhere and I just have to trust it's a good angle to the story and I'll just follow it through, even though that's not part of my initial plan. And sometimes I said, like, the second book, the person who I thought was going to be the killer, I changed it towards the end. And I was like, oh no, this is better. This is better. So I think you just have to trust yourself. And always with that first draft, you just have to trust yourself to just get that story out, no matter what shape or form it takes. And then you can always fix it with your rewrites.
And I think that shows that one really important thing for writers is to be out in the world, talking to people, looking at scenery. And coming back to the pandemic, I think that's why I found it so hard, because you're trying to write in this vacuum and people always say, where do you get your ideas? And they're everywhere. It can be a fridge that you see by the Thames, you know, it can be a conversation that you've had with a drunken guy, you know, after a council meeting. And so you just need to be out there talking to people.
Yeah, sparks can be anywhere. Yeah. We should have put you in the middle, because you're like the fancy plotter. Right, which I'm going to invent a new way of writing, the pancy plotter.
I like that.
That's what we're going to call you.
Yeah.
The fancy plotter.
Nadine the pancy plotter. Yeah, head of the Crime Writers Association. She's the pancy plotter.
My new tagline.
Yeah. So we're going to go to audience questions in just a minute or two. I just wanted to have one last one, and then we'll hand our queens of crime to you. So I'd just like to know about your own reading, basically. Who do you read? Outside of crime, or do you read crime being crime writers?
I've also gone through.
Yeah, no, I do read a lot of crime, and I think you do have to read in your genre if you're going to write it. And coming back to this thing where crime is seen as a bit of a lower form. You know, there are books like Girl A, The Last House on Needless Street, The First Day of Spring. I can name you 10, 20 books. Come and find me after if you want recommendations. So yeah, I definitely read crime. I also read outside of crime. The last book I really, really loved was Demon Copperhead by Barbara Kingsolver, you know, which won the Women's Prize for Fiction, was shortlisted for the Pulitzer Prize, or did it win the Pulitzer Prize? It's sold a million copies, but it's a gorgeous, gorgeous book. So I highly recommend that.
Fantastic.
I read everything. I don't read within genre. We talked about Malcolm X. That's what I grew up reading. Everything that Malcolm X ever wrote in a speech, I read. What do I read? So I read a book I've just read, which I really recommend, is called We Who Will Remain. And it's not out till the 15th, but it's by a wonderful writer called Kasim Ali. And it's set in Birmingham, and it's about being a British Asian kid, just being a young man. So it's kind of, it's timely in terms of if you think about adolescence, all that conversation around that, but also around grooming gangs. So about what happens to young men when they're left alone to their own devices and they have no role models. Having said that, I'm also rereading Practical Magic. Did anybody read Practical Magic?
No.
It's made into a film with Nicole Kidman. And
was it a book?
Yeah, it was a series of books. So the world is on fire and I can't handle it. So I've lost myself in these books.
But I do that when there's so much. I mean, I love history, I love politics, so I will go down a rabbit hole with it. But there's so much going on in the world that I just go to the opposite end of the spectrum. So I'll read all the rom-coms. I love a good rom-com. So I'll read the rom-coms. But I do read in my genre, so I'll read all the crime books. I'm reading Attica Locke at the moment, who's she's an amazing writer, because I'm interviewing her later this month. So reading a lot of crime. What else do I read? Oh, but also I'm also a really big comic book fan. So anyone who knows me knows that. So I read a lot of comic books. Wow. And I always say comic books are the best way to learn about character development, especially if you're writing a series.
And who would you recommend?
Anyone.
Anyone?
Literally anyone.
It's a massive Batman fan, aren't you?
I'm a massive Batman fan.
Wow. Wonderful. Well, we'll hand over to audience questions. Have we got a microphone? Oh, fantastic. So if you have any questions, now is your time. We've got 10, 15 minutes or so, which is wonderful. There we go. Just give us a second for the mic. There we go. Ah, you're on. Yeah.
Thank you. It's so amazing listening to you. But I just want to know, how do you do it? You're professional women, you've got families, you've got other things going on, and yet you can write a book. Please, could you just bottle it? Do you conjure up additional hours?
How? It's a disease. Wow. It's a disease.
Can you pass it on? Can you pass it on? how do you do it? How do you find that time to do it?
I think you have to give yourself permission. You have to give yourself permission to write the story that you want to write, and write it in whatever form you have to, whether it's on your phone, whether it's on little bits of notepaper. Don't let anything define you. And just whenever you find bits of minutes, just write it. And that's how I've written pretty much all of my books, except for the last one. You know, I've got three, so my eldest is 11, my youngest is 6, and there's not much time, but there's a lot of waiting around for kids to do things, or after school clubs, or picking them up, or in between making dinner. I just make a lot of notes, and just don't let anything define you. Don't think, I must sit down with a chunk of 2 hours to write it. For me, that doesn't work. I just have to write it all the time.
Yeah.
I'm not saying it's the best way to do it, because I'm completely nuts, but I'm compelled to write, and that's how I do it.
Yeah. I mean, I've always described it as stealing time. Because you're never gonna have like the perfect 5 hours in the day. You'll never have the perfect computer or office space. I remember I'd be in court and I said, there's a lot of waiting time. So there's moments where I'm waiting for my case to come on. I'll be like typing, even if it's just like 5 sentences in my chapter, I would use that time to write. And, you know, it'd be the weekends and the evenings, but just finding pockets of time to write. And also sometimes it's just telling the story that you want to tell. I think sometimes you can get so distracted by what's number one in the Sunday Times bestsellers list, or what's got the latest deal, and you're thinking, this is a story that I have to write. But you just need to write the story that you want to tell. And once you're committed to that, you will find, as I said, you'll find a little pockets of time to write your book.
I think for me, I try not to get too wedded to quality, because when I first started, it was like, oh, what I'm writing has to be really good. Whereas now, I don't even call my first draft, I call it draft zero, because sometimes I just literally will write the mechanics of a scene. So, you know, Kia walks in, Kia sits down, Kia says this, rather than adding any flair to it, just so I can get to the end of the book. And that's like a huge psychological hurdle that you've vaulted, because you know you've got enough story there, and then I go back and add the quality.
Yeah. Do you use WhatsApp or anything like that? It's great. WhatsApp yourself. WhatsApp yourself.
Yeah. Dictate.
Yeah. Just if you have an idea and you're sat on anywhere like here, just WhatsApp you. And you can just then cut and paste it into your documents.
Mm. Wonderful question.
Good afternoon. I just want to say thank you, first of all. We run a book club, and the most popular genre we've had so far is crime, and it all started off with a can. So we're eager to see the final installment. When is that coming on TV?
Okay, so the TV thing, it's not BBC Studios, it's someone else.
Oh, is it now?
It's pretty big. I'm not allowed to talk about it. I've had to sign an NDA, but it's happening. So
it's happening.
Yeah.
And those people next door, we actually love that as well. So thank you. So we meet every month, and crime has been such a popular genre in our group.
Thank you so much.
Yeah, thank you. Back there.
Does it get easier the more you write?
God,
after the first book. So you don't get the first book, you're like, wow, I've done it. And then the second one just like, boom.
No. Every time, guaranteed, I'll open up the document and I'm like, I'll email someone or text someone like, how do I do this? Like, it feels like every book feels like you're doing it for the very, very first time. It doesn't get easy. And I think it's because you always want to make sure you're doing a good job. And if you've had, like success with your previous books and you've had a good response to that, I think in the back of your mind, it's like, I don't want to be letting anyone down. I don't want anyone coming up to me and going, Nadine, this is absolute rubbish. So no, it doesn't get easier, but it's a good problem to have, to be in this position where I am able to write the next book. But no, I wish it was easy. I want it to be easy.
No, I heard the writer David Nicol, who wrote One Day, which has sold a million copies, say it never gets easier. And I remember feeling quite disheartened when I read that. Yeah. I thought, surely it does. And it doesn't. But what I do now have is the confidence to know, like you said, the faith, to know that I can get to the end. So when I have those days where I'm like, I can't see myself out of this issue, or I can't find the words, I know that they'll come eventually, and I know I'll get to the end. And if there's a plot hole or something, I've got the tools now in my toolbox to be able to fix it. So that does help. But yeah, no, it doesn't get easier, sadly.
Same. It doesn't get easier, but you have the techniques.
Wouldn't it be funny if you're like, oh yeah, book two was so easy.
I just got up in the morning. It was there.
Yeah, I'm starting book five in September, which means they'll be getting text messages like, how the hell do I open a chapter? Because that's how it feels.
You do get those techniques, though. You remember what worked before, and you kind of tap into those. But no, and every time you sit there and you think, it's magic writing a book. It's just this, because you make a world out of thin air. And so it's like, how do I remember those spells to kind of weave it all back?
Yeah.
In the middle there.
If you were advising a new-to-you reader, would you advise starting with one of your early works or the latest?
See, I try, and I've been told you can read each of mine as a standalone. So if you pick up The Kill List, which is the third book, you won't feel like, oh my God, I need to go back and read the first two in order to understand what this world is and who these characters are and how they interact with each other. So you can read them as a standalone. So you could pick this one up first.
Yeah, same. Mm. I mean, this is the answer the publishers tell you to give, but the latest one. No, but I mean, What Happens in the Dark is probably the novel I'm proudest of. So I'd probably say start there. And if not, then maybe with my first one, which is called Take It Back.
I would start with The Khan. You can start with Vengeance. It is a standalone. But if you start with Vengeance, then there's a lot of spoilers in it for The Khan. So go with that one and then go with Vengeance.
But also The Fridge is in The Kill List. So if you want to know about The Fridge.
You'll never look at your fridge in the same way again. There was somebody here first.
I'm still recovering from The Khan. I haven't managed to reach the book to it. Fabulous book. I love discovering new women crime writers. Crime is my comfort reading. It's my go-to when I really want to read something that, I read loads of books, but I'm just wondering whether you think crime writing is changing I decided that I was no more going to read a book where a woman's body is found on page two in a place somewhere where she shouldn't have been, somehow implying that she's in the wrong place. And it was somehow a woman's body's found and it's her responsibility to have been there. So, you know, I just wonder whether you think it's crime fiction is moving on from that into a different way of exploring the world.
I think there are books where you do get the beautiful dead girl, you know, but I think rather than using her as a device to move the narrative forward, crime writers are thinking more carefully about her life. Who was she, trying to make her into a well-rounded character? I definitely think we're moving away from kind of gratuitous scenes of kind of assault and really thinking, does this move the story forward? So the short answer is yes, I think so. And I think that's the right direction in which to go. I don't shy away from, I mean, my books aren't very graphic. They're very much rooted in real life. That said, you know, acts of great violence are performed against women. And so this idea that crime writers should never talk about violence or really graphic violence, I'm not sure how I feel about that either, because it does happen, as we've seen in cases like Sarah Everard. And so as long as you're not doing it in a gratuitous way, then I think you can.
Yeah. Mm. I've always said from the very beginning of my books, there needs to be a point to the violence. It just, 'cause I've read books where it's just the violence is just there just to fill pages, and that frustrates me. So with all the victims in my book, they're not just, it's not just a plot device. So they are just as fully formed as every other character in the book. And with the victims, you'll see not only, I suppose, what's happened to them, but also the effect on the families, because it doesn't just stop with a body on a page. There is a knock-on effect from that, and that's always going to be with the families. And that's something that Henley also focuses on also. So you will always see her interacting and engaging with the victims of the family. But I always feel like crime, it does reflect the world we live in. So you can't ignore the fact that this is happening in the world, but it's just in the way you show it in the books. I think so. Everything, it has to earn its place there. It just can't be there because I just need to entertain someone.
You know, writing's really good therapy, and you learn a lot about yourself when you write a book. And it's only when I look back at the books that I've written that I realise I actually haven't killed any women in the books. I just killed a lot of men, but no women. So what does that say about me?
So you got issues.
I've got... It's interesting. I've not killed any... There's no dead women in the books, which is... There's a lot of things happen to a lot of men, but it's not been intentional. I think it's just my perception of the world and what I wanted to show. But equally, women are killed, aren't they? Mm. How many women are killed on a daily basis? The hands of their partners, family. So there is a balance to be had. Yeah. Yeah. I don't know what the answer is to it. Maybe stop killing women. Then we'll stop writing about it.
Watch out for book number four, though, when you decide to go back one last time and then there's just...
Kill all the women.
I didn't do this in the last three.
I wrote Vengeance, the first one, The Khan, a lot of people talked about it as this, it's a real book about women and female empowerment. And when I reread it to write the second one, the thing I realised in it was I had empowered women, but I'd empowered one woman. And so when I wrote Vengeance, I set about rectifying that because I thought, hang on, she's done this. Yep, but she's still got this group of men around her. So how do we rectify that? Okay, let's move on from that bit and bring in more women.
Cool. We have to be very quick with these last two questions now.
You asked what I was going to ask much better, really. I was going to ask a really broad question about, like you, I love crime fiction. And I've read it for donkey's years. And I also like police procedurals. Before I came out this morning, I watched an episode of 24 Hours in Police Custody, which I love. And I know a lot of women that are really into crime fiction. And it's kind of counterintuitive because we don't tend to commit crimes as women very much.
Oh, they do. I'm telling you this one. Women are more calculating. It sounds terrible. Women are more, the ones I dealt with, they're much more calculating when they're committing crimes than the men.
I think you're probably right.
But do they tend to...
I'm trying to work out, probably as therapy for myself, is why it is that so many of us are so intrigued and fascinated and love crime, crime so much.
I don't know what the right answer is. Like, I always feel that But if you're reading crime and you're reading what the worst of society can do in this book, it makes you look at your own life and maybe a much, you know, this is, thank God, you know, it happened. It hasn't happened to me. And if this isn't my immediate world, I mean, that's the only answer I could think of. Yeah, I think you can always find something in crime to maybe to relate to maybe a little part of your life. I can't watch 24 hours in police custody. No, because it was work. And I knew what it was like to be sitting in the police station at 4 o'clock in the morning for hours with someone. So, yeah, I don't watch it.
Okay, we're going to have to begin winding up. Colin?
Just a short question. Well, I've got two questions, but a short one was in the title, What Happens in the Dark? Does it also stay in the dark?
No, because one of Safa's jobs, so her editor says to us, you know, the job of a journalist is to journey into darkness and shine light into it. And so in the course of the story, she manages to do that. So there is some light at the end.
Then, Simon, you talked about not naming Bradford because you didn't want to reinforce any kind of negative stereotypes of Bradford. I wonder whether you approach that to your characters as well, because a lot of the stories that tell about people of colour in the newspapers are pretty negative stories. So how do you curate or navigate that idea that you may be reinforcing negative stories by writing about crime?
There's a lot of bad white people in the books as well. So it's a lot of very posh bad white people in there too. I try and make people multi-layered and not just have one character of colour. There's just a lot of people from a lot of different backgrounds doing a lot of different things. So having more stories, basically.
Yeah, we're going to have to close out there. So I just wanted to close out by saying one of the reasons that, in fact, probably the main reason Writers' Mosaic exists is that we saw a need for writers of the global majority to be able to write what they wanted to without having to kind of always kind of bow to colonialism. And of course, there's still a lot of that around. But what I find myself celebrating in this moment with Kia, with Saima and Nadine is that we have three amazing women who have found their way to do that, which is just an astonishing thing, to write what they want to write, which is actually much harder than you think it is, given the way the world is right now. So it's amazing to see that kind of mission kind of written large with you three. So can we celebrate our three global crime queens, please?
Thank you.
Thank you so much.
And to give you a round of applause as well.
Thank you for joining us for this episode of the Explore Words, Discover Worlds podcast with Bradford Literature Festival. If you enjoyed this episode and you'd like to help support the podcast, please subscribe, share this episode with others, and leave a rating. Mark your calendars for the return of Bradford Literature Festival, Friday the 3rd to Sunday the 12th of July, 2026.